Grant Achatz attained one of cooking's highest honors last weekend, the James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef. Achatz is only 34 years old, young for a James Beard winner, and far too young for the news he got from his doctors last year. He was diagnosed with late-stage tongue cancer and told he might only have a few months to live. Rather than opt to remove part of his tongue, Achatz chose chemotherapy and radiation. And after months of treatment, it seems to have worked. He's been cancer-free for half a year now, but there was a cost, a big one for a chef. The radiation took away his sense of taste. But he pushed through the pain and kept cooking. Achatz is known for elaborate, whimsical dishes, sort of performance art on a plate. At his restaurant, Alinea, in Chicago, dinner can be made from as many as 30 tiny courses. Gourmet magazine named it the best restaurant in America in 2006, only a year and a half after it opened. Grant Achatz, congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
So I know after you get an award, you're supposed to say, I don't do it for the awards, but what does being named Outstanding Chef by James Beard, winning that award, what does it mean for you?
Well, you know, it certainly has some personal meaning, especially after this year in particular. I look at it as a very, you know, poignant bookend. I mean, it ends kind of a tumultuous year and is a great jumping off point for the following year.
And because of it, is the waiting list at Alinea now like 4.5 years instead of 3.5?
Yeah, well, let's just say that, you know, it made the phone ring pretty good.
So, like, I'm sure that you have a lot of people claiming to be your first cousin who can't get a reservation.
Right.
Yeah.
I tried to call the restaurant and speak to somebody on Monday, you know, a day after the awards.
Yeah.
I couldn't even get through to my own restaurant. So.
And you have the hotline, right? You know the special number.
And that
didn't
work. So. There you go.
Now, I read a good quote where you talked about wanting to create nostalgia and emotion through food. Can you mention maybe a specific dish that does both things?
We try to kind of pull on these emotional triggers, and we do that a couple of different ways. But one way in particular is the use of intentional aroma with mm-hmm. food. And so when I'm creating dishes, I'll often try to just go into my own mind and try to pick out specific things that I feel are important in my life. And one of them is I grew up in Michigan, so my favorite season happens to be fall, and one of the things that is very indicative of fall to me as a young child was the smell of burning leaves, because, of course, you know, when I was growing up, it was still environmentally accepted to rake the leaves that were in your front yard out to the side of the road and, you know, jump in them a couple of times and light them on fire.
Right.
So one of the things that we've done kind of involving that was actually take oak branches that still had the colored leaves attached and use it like a bamboo skewer some food on the ends, pheasant and roasted shallot and cider, a gelée made of cider, kind of the quintessential fall or autumn ingredients. Tempura fry just the end that covers the food composition. And then before it's served to the diner, actually light the leaves on fire, blow them out so you have this smoldering oak leaf aroma. And it really pulls on people in a very powerful way. It's not only food at that point, but you're actually transporting people back to a time in their life, which is, you know, it's a very powerful thing.
What's the biggest disaster in terms of trying to burn something or evoke a smell?
Well, you know, a disaster in that one in particular. I was doing a photo shoot a couple of months ago and basically burnt the carpet in the dining room.
That evokes something else.
You always got to be careful, right? When you're playing with torches. So,
tell me about when did you first start feeling that something was wrong or funny going on with your tongue or inside your mouth?
2003, I noticed kind of a small white dot on my tongue and just kind of figured it was somehow I bit my tongue or it was like a canker sore
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
But it didn't go away for a long time?
Didn't go away, and then repeated trips to the dentist, you know, they kind of misguided me and told me I was stressed and young because of the hours I was working and under the pressure and that, in fact, I was biting my tongue and grinding my teeth at night,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And so when you finally got to the right doctor, I assume it was an oncologist, and he presented you with the choices of radiation or, you know, cutting out part of the tongue. Did you think, I don't know what your first thought was, but, you know, how did you think about that this could very much affect your sense of taste? How did you process that?
Well, we went, you know, once I got the positive pathology report back and got my diagnosis, we kind of went on this crusade to find treatment, the best possible treatment. And we ended up at 5 hospitals throughout the course of that, and each of them recommended what they called the standard of care, which was surgery first. Mm-hmm. And that would have entailed removing 3/4 of my tongue. Obviously, that's not, you know, that doesn't present a very good quality of life for anyone in particular, but especially for a chef that relies on that ability to use that sense of taste every day in their career. So, you know, I went on the search for an alternative treatment and luckily found the University of Chicago, essentially right in my backyard, ironically, that had a new protocol that was kind of based on organ preservation. And their belief was that kind of reversing what had typically been the standard of care for 25 years or more, which was surgery followed by radiation chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
They had a new drug that they felt was going to help eliminate cancerous cells, and then only use surgery if absolutely necessary at the very end.
And from what I read, it seems to have worked, knock on wood. But tell me, what's the state of your taste now?
Well, it's impossible to measure, right?
Right, yeah.
If you go to the ophthalmologist, they can tell you exactly what your vision is, and same for your hearing. But something like taste or smell, they really have no way of measuring it. And it's kind of in your mind. If I had to guess, I'd say it's probably somewhere around 50% back.
And is our specific taste more gone than others? I think the four tastes are sweet, bitter, sour, salty, then there's this other kind of substance thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all the sweet sensations came back to me first. And, kind of salt followed closely behind, but not fully as I recall it. And, you know, so it comes back very fragmented and kind of, you know, disjointed. But they say it can take up to a year for you to recover from the treatment. So, you know, I'm 6 or so months out. I still have a long way to go. And, yeah, I'd say I'm about halfway there.
What kind of accommodations do you make in the kitchen? Do you have a taster? How do you tell if the food is good?
Well, you have to, you know, the food that we create is very conceptual. And it's, you know, it's very artistically driven. So the creation process takes place in my head anyways. And I need the validation for the final concept to come from my chef's cuisine and my sous chef. I need to rely on people to help me get that final tweaking at the very end.
Mm-hmm. You know, the obvious parallel that I thought of is with Beethoven. I don't know if you've listened to him or even read about his life after he went deaf as a composer.
Right.
But one of the things that he did is that period, he wrote the Eroica Symphony, which was his third, right as he went deaf, and he got bold for a moment, and then he got romantic. But did your loss of taste, has it changed you? I guess this is like an Oprah-y question, but are you taking more risks? Are you any bolder? Has it changed your personality at all?
I don't think personality, really. It certainly has changed the cooking. It's educated me on what flavor is and how the certain tastes come together. So I think conceptually it's actually given me a little bit more freedom and a little bit more confidence, ironically enough, because now I feel I have a greater understanding of how all the flavors work together. So I'm able to compose things that I probably normally wouldn't have understood.
Grant Achatz is chef and owner of Chicago restaurant Alinea. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, congratulations.
You're welcome.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolf. When NPR's Elizabeth Tannen was growing up, her father often baked chocolate madeleines for her and her friends. She has written about it for Kitchen Window Online and joins me today in the studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Bonnie.
So in the piece you did for Kitchen Window, you talked about being 8 or 9, and your dad mm-hmm. would make Madeleines for you to take into school.
Yeah, it was like the highlight of this event when I was in third and fourth grade. I had a wonderful teacher who held these writing workshops every day. She had just sort of discovered writing herself, I think, and imposed this very disciplined but really wonderful workshop program onto us. And so the celebration of our work was in the form of these publishing parties, which would happen a few times a year, where we'd read these stories that we'd, you know, quote, published and bound and watercolored and all that. And I don't remember terribly much about the parties, but I do remember that the Madeleines were always a highlight. My dad, for some reason, would always make Madeleines for those parties.
Why did your father settle on Madeleines?
Well, you know, I never asked him as a kid, as I say in the piece. It was just something that he, you know, getting kids take a lot of things, especially desserts, for granted.
I mean, it's pretty exotic.
Right. Well, I had no idea at the time that there was anything exotic about it. But when I asked him, when I was writing the piece, he just said that he had come across the recipe, he thinks, in an airline magazine when he was flying someplace. He had never made the lemon almond kind, which is the traditional kind, I later learned. It's not that he was bored with that. He just... they didn't interest him in the chocolate, he thought was interesting. And so he started making them, and he said that he thought that they seemed like finger food, but elegant, and that would be an appropriate thing for kids of that age, I guess.
What a good dad.
Yeah, he's a very good dad, yes, and a very good baker.
How did he start baking?
It was actually when his first wife, who died of cancer, was ill. I think that, you know, it was obviously very difficult. He had three young boys at the time, and they were all spending a lot of time in the hospital. And he's told me that something that helped him cope with that was baking. As I mentioned, the piece, he's very diligent about his hobbies. And so for a long time, he was very into photography. And lately, he's been very into wine, and he gets very sort of obsessive about things, which is something that I admire. It's not a quality that I have. Anyhow, so the baking was a release for him, and he did it in sort of an extreme way for a long time, and it subsided since then, but he still does bake.
And when did you learn of the Madeleine's place in literary importance, in Proust's, that it opened the floodgates of Proust's memory?
You know, I actually have a specific memory about that. I was a history major in college, and it was the first day of a European history class, and my professor passed around a New Yorker cartoon that was a picture of Proust eating a Madeleine, and I think he passed the cartoon around and was looking for one of us to offer some sort of explanation. And Proust wasn't identified, I guess, in the cartoon. And so it was passed around, and then it was the last kid who was sort of the genius of the class that actually knew the story and knew that it was Proust, because, you know, he was there with a cup of tea and a Madeleine.
Have you read Remembrance of Things Past?
No, I sort of, you know, maybe it's a little silly, but I feel a sort of personal claim to my own Madeleine nostalgia, and so I sort of refuse to have anything to do with Proust's story. I mean, maybe I'll read it eventually.
You said your dad also baked wedding cakes for family wedding cakes?
Yes, he baked my parents' wedding cake when they got married, and then I have three brothers, two of whom have been married, and he baked those wedding cakes. And he also baked the wedding cake for my mother's best friend, but I think that was such an ordeal that he vowed after that he was only going to bake wedding cakes for his children.
Were these big weddings?
Oh, yeah. No, they were quite... I remember... But, you know, every night he would bake a sort of test cake, a test layer, and we would sample.
Is he still baking?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not, you know, I think he went through a phase of baking constantly. You know, I mean, he actually at one point attempted to make a little bit of a business out of baking breads and pastries. Now he basically just does it for special occasions. But he always, you know, there's an expectation that if it's a holiday or the family is together, then my father will bake. And he never can just bake one thing. He's got to bake several desserts.
Well, he sounds like an excellent father, and I hope he has a wonderful Father's Day.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Oh, you're welcome, Bonnie. Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The nation's economy may seem shaky where you are, but in California's Napa Valley, money and wine were flowing freely this past weekend. The occasion, the annual Napa Valley Wine Auction, which raises millions for charity. As NPR's John McChesney reports, there's a reason people call it the Billionaire's Bash.
Nearly 3,000 people flood into the Napa Valley for 3 days of dinner parties, lunches, and food served up by the area's best restaurants. It costs a pretty penny to get in here. The live action begins with the barrel auction, where over 100 vintners offer tastes from their barrels. Siphons dip into the barrels and squirt tastes into hundreds of glasses. Bells ring as new bids are posted. We stopped at the Schaefer Winery and talked with Doug Schaefer.
Well, Schaefer's doing really well, up to, my goodness, $10,000 a case. That's pretty incredible. There's some very generous people here today.
Schaefer credits the over $800 a bottle price to that generosity. In a room next to the barrel auction, you can view what are called lots, groups of wine and other enticements that will be bid on in the big auction. One lot has a Lexus SUV filled with high-value wines. Another sports a Chanel diamond necklace. Then there's a simple display of six bottles of wine resting on a wooden cart. Kathy McClure of Mom Napa Valley happens by to explain what we're looking at.
So this is six magnums of the first vintage of Screaming Eagle, which is 1992, and dinner for eight. This will be a big lot.
It certainly doesn't look big, but Ms. McClure turned out to be right. On Saturday night, about 800 of the glitterati gather in front of a big white tent at the exclusive Meadowood Resort. Dennis Cakebread of Cakebread Winery is a happy man.
So spectacular with all the beautiful sunlight coming in and the white tent and people all decked out looking forward to a good time. And, you know, if this isn't the modern Camelot, I don't know what is.
Jay Leno opened the auction with a monologue we couldn't record, and he helped out in the auction with a few jokes. One lot included a restored Austin Healey sports car.
It's one of the few places you can actually get drinking and driving for $150,000.
A walk-on on the television show Grey's Anatomy sold for $480,000. And then we came to those six magnums of the cult wine, Screaming Eagle.
Twice now, $500,000. So, Paddle 23, $500,000.
In case you're wondering, that comes to about $7,000 a glass. And it belongs to David Lee, at age 32, a Shanghai multi-billionaire.
$500,000 for six magnums of Screaming Eagle.
Yes.
That's a lot of money, huh?
Yeah, because I really love Napa wine, you know, and I think Screaming Eagle is one of the best wine in the world.
In the center of the tent sits Oprah, like a queen, surrounded by vintners trying to get her to sample their wares. She has about 20 glasses in front of her. She says she used to drink French wines.
Now I'm a Napa girl.
At one point, auctioneer Humphrey Butler gets a little excited as he's auctioning off donations to the local Clinique Olay, where many farm workers receive health care.
Oh, yes, Joy. All right, 260. I've got a sort of tingling in my groin now.
Joy Kraft is the person he's referring to, and she didn't stop at 260,000.
So what was your small contribution
today? $500,000 to Clinique Olay. $500,000 will go a long way toward health care in this valley.
But not everyone is pleased with the conspicuous display of wealth here, even though it goes toward good causes. Bill Hill is a vintner who's worked in the valley for 34 years.
The thing that bothers me is that I think it takes away a little of the focus from what winemaking really is. You know, that we're farmers that grow something and create something that will make people that use it enjoy it.
But in spite of feelings like that and a slumping stock market, the dollars flowed like wine here. Final take, $10.4 million. Just shy of the record. John McChesney, NPR News, San Francisco.
Broadbent had never sold anything quite like this before. A Chateau Lafite from 1787, it was the oldest authenticated vintage red wine ever to come up for auction at Christie's, and that was the least of its merits. The bottle was engraved with the initials THJ. THJ are the initials of Thomas Jefferson. Almost miraculously, the bottle was full of wine and appeared to have survived two centuries intact.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, Benjamin Wallace reads from his nonfiction book, The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine. this, Wallace's first book, was a bestseller when it came out and received critical raves for combining a great mystery with a sensational history of wine and wine snobs. That one very, very, very expensive bottle sparked rumors throughout the wine world. Had it really belonged to Jefferson, or was it a fake? The Billionaire's Vinegar is a story about colossal wealth, decadence, lust, and deceit. This reading was recorded in May 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit and read a little bit, and then at the end take questions if anyone has any. I wanted to start by talking about how I got into this story. In 2000, I was a magazine journalist, and I was kind of a foodie. I like to cook. I like to eat. I wasn't necessarily a wine person, but I wanted to learn more about wine, and I found the offerings somewhat frustrating. They were all kind of wine for dummies or, you know, a history of weather patterns in the Côte d'Or. So they were kind of primers or they were encyclopedic. And I was a lover of books like Simon Winchester's The Professor and the Madman, where you'd read a true story and you'd get to the end of this great story and realize suddenly you'd learned all this stuff about the Oxford English Dictionary and lexicography that you never would have tried to learn if the book was billed as such. And I thought there was really an opening for a book about wine like that. I wanted a book like that to exist. And so I started looking around for a story like that. And the first thing I heard was the phrase, the most expensive bottle of wine in the world. And I wanted to know, you know, what could that bottle possibly be? And it turned out to be this $156,000 bottle of Chateau Lafite, 200 years old, supposedly. The property of Thomas Jefferson, and it had just, you know, survived two centuries entombed in this hidden cellar in Paris, only to be accidentally stumbled upon in the mid-80s. And, you know, that intrigued me, and I wanted to learn a bit more, and I found out that the guy who had discovered these bottles was a elusive German wine dealer, former pop band manager named Hardy Rodenstock, and he wouldn't say that much about where he had found the bottles. He just said it was a cellar in Paris from a building with foundations dating to the 1750s, and that was about all he would say. He wouldn't say exactly where he'd found them. He wouldn't say exactly who owned the building. And when he was asked more questions, he always had some kind of dodge, like, you know, I don't want to get the owner in trouble. He didn't report the bottles for tax reasons or that sort of thing. And by the time I heard about it in 2000, these bottles had been known about for 15 years, and the mystery had never been solved. And I thought I would try my hand at trying to solve this mystery. The whole story began with this auction in 1985, and the auctioneer was this incredible character, Michael Broadbent, who was the founding head of Christie's wine department. He has probably the most experienced palate in the world. He's drunk more old wines than anybody else, and he rides around London on his three-speed ladies' bicycle with a basket, and he uses interesting language to describe wine, like one wine he compared to chocolate and schoolgirls' uniforms. So he was the auctioneer at this auction in 1985, and the first passage is from that auction. "The taste of the wine he was selling right now in London, just past 2:30 p.m. on Thursday, December 5th, 1985, was impossible to know. December 5th had special meaning for Broadbent. It was the same date that James Christie, in 1766, had held the auction house's very first sale. Moments earlier, Broadbent had stepped up to the roast room in a three-piece suit with a pocket square and peered out at the room through his eyeglasses. Lot 337 was the first item of the afternoon session and had been carefully removed from its green felt berth in a glass case nearby. Lucy Godzel, a secretary in Broadbent's office, held the bottle aloft for the room to see. She looked very Christie's, blonde, headband, pearl necklace, and Broadbent liked her. She was smart, hardworking, and pretty. Broadbent had never sold anything quite like this before. A Chateau Lafite from 1787, it was the oldest authenticated vintage red wine ever to come up for auction at Christie's, and that was the least of its merits. The bottle was engraved with the initials THJ. As Broadbent had described it in the auction catalog, THJ are the initials of Thomas Jefferson. Almost miraculously, the bottle was full of wine and appeared to have survived two centuries intact. The container itself was beautiful and distinctive. This is one time, Broadbent quipped to the crowd, when the buyer will get something back on the bottle. The admittedly fragmentary tale of how the bottle had been found only added to its mystique. According to Hardy Rodenstock, the German collector who had consigned the bottle to Christie's, in the spring of 1985, workers tearing down a house in Paris had broken through a false wall in the basement and happened upon a hidden cache of extremely old wines. The Lafitte, inscribed with the initials of the founding father, who had lived in Paris from 1784 to 1789 and was the foremost American wine connoisseur of his day, had been among them. The integrity of the seals and the high fill levels, Rodenstock had told Broadbent, were remarkable for their age. The cellar had been almost hermetically preserved, its steady temperature in the sweet spot of 50 to 57 degrees Fahrenheit. Rodenstock theorized that the bottles had been walled up to protect them during the chaos of the French Revolution and had lain undisturbed for 200 years. Not surprisingly, Rodenstock refused to divulge the precise location, the exact number of bottles, or anything else about the discovery, despite Broadbent's entreaties. Rodenstock was the leading private collector in Europe, and he had already made a name for himself in rare wine circles as an unusually skilled bottle hunter. Though he was a longtime customer of Christie's, Rodenstock was a competitor when it came to obtaining private cellars. Private cellar purchases were often cash deals that went unreported to tax authorities. A certain reticence about his sources was to be expected. Broadbent felt there were a couple of possibilities. One was that the bottle had indeed been discovered during the excavations of the old Marais district in Paris, much of which had recently been torn up and redeveloped. A rumor less credited by Broadbent, and which he had no intention of putting in the catalog copy, was that the bottle had been part of some sort of Nazi cellar. So, besides Broadbent and Rodenstock, one of the great parts of working on this book was the incredible number of larger-than-life, incredibly colorful characters who populate the story. And Michael Broadbent was one of them, and Hardy Rodenstock was another. He is known for two things. One is throwing these lavish annual tastings where he forbids anyone to spit. And Michael Broadbent would keep a spittoon in his lap, but if he caught you spitting, he would throw you out. And the other thing he's famous for is this uncanny knack for discovering, you know, lost cellars, like the Tsar's lost cellar. I mean, he had this ability, kind of a diviner's ability, to find these cellars that was somewhat suspicious. A third character in the book is Bill Koch, and he is a Florida billionaire who owns four of the Jefferson bottles. Along with the bottle that the Forbes family bought, there was the rest of this cash. And Bill Koch bought four of these bottles. And in 2005, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts offered to put on an exhibition of his collections. He collects a lot of things, paintings, models of the America's Cup boat, because he actually won the America's Cup. He spent $68 million to win the America's Cup in 1992. And the Boston Museum of Fine Arts asked him for provenances for all of the objects that were going to go in the show. And he wanted to put the Jefferson bottles in, and he realized he did not have a lot of paperwork for them. And so he, you know, sicked his curatorial team on it. And they said, yeah, there's not really much paperwork here. And he ended up spending over $1 million on an investigation to get to the bottom of the provenance of these bottles. And he hired ex-FBI agents and ex-Scotland Yard agents. And the next passage I'm going to read is about how Bill Koch decided to launch this investigation. And he had had some experience with provenance issues. He had owned some extremely rare Greek coins, which turned out to belong to the Turkish government, and he had to return them. And so he wanted to be really careful this time around to make sure that these bottles had a solid chain of custody. Koch could have been forgiven at this point for choosing to leave well enough alone. It must have been tempting, simply not to know, to continue to believe he possessed a treasure that might have belonged to Thomas Jefferson. He risked embarrassment if it were revealed that the bottles he had paid so much for and taken such pride in were not what they seemed. He must have known that this was strictly a rich man's problem, though, as likely to arouse Schadenfreude as sympathy. He also was painfully aware that he made a soft, fat target for the press. Bill Koch inherited his wealth originally, and he was in litigation with his brothers for decades over the family fortune, and they eventually settled for $470 million to Bill Koch in the 80s, although the litigation dragged on, but that's the background for what's about to come. When he had subpoenaed his 82-year-old mother, all the jackals could focus on was the stroke she'd had a few months earlier, totally disregarding that she sided with his brothers in the fraternal feud. Yes, he'd wanted to compel her testimony, but after all, he hadn't known about the stroke at the time. Once he found out about it, he abandoned the effort. When he had expelled his mistress from a $2.5 million condo he owned at the Boston Four Seasons, the media harped on how she was a single mother and the eviction had taken place on Christmas Eve, so that he could throw a Christmas party in the 3,700 square foot spread. Never mind that he could have evicted her 30 days earlier. When he was arrested for domestic violence after his second wife accused him of punching her in the stomach, and threatening to beat his whole family to death with his belt, the hacks were all over it, neglecting to point out that witnesses to the altercation had disputed his wife's account and that she later recanted it. The charges were ultimately dismissed. Although a court issued a restraining order against Koch, his Palm Beach estate was spacious enough that he was able to stay in a beach house on the property and still be in compliance. Koch's darker side was mitigated by a disarming willingness to introspect in public. About his years in psychoanalysis, say, "For a long time, I didn't think I was worth shit." Or his short fuse, "I could be a really nasty prick. I'd go up to my secretary and say, 'You dumb shit, why'd you make that mistake? I was that kind of guy.'" But the candor didn't always help his case. A 1994 Vanity Fair profile written with Koch's masochistic cooperation had been a mutilation without anesthetic, likening his paranoia to Richard Nixon's and his dissembling to Bill Clinton's, and saying Koch is a man whose closet is free of skeletons in large part because they all seem to be turning somersaults in the living room. Worst of all was the Boston press, which delighted in quoting from naughty love letters between Koch and his X-rated Protestant princess, as the evicted mistress styled herself. "My body parts are like moist orchids in bloom," she wrote in one fax. Koch, somewhat less steamily, described his ardor as "beyond calculation by the largest computers." Boston reporters almost uniformly deemed the MFA show crass and egotistical. Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam was especially caustic, gratuitously noting that Koch rhymes with joke and disinterring the moldy beat-his-family-to-death-with-a-belt threat allegation. With Koch talking about a lawsuit, the Globe subsequently ran a fairly groveling editor's note acknowledging the conflicting evidence. But who reads editor's notes? Koch felt he could not get a fair shake. On the other hand, Koch couldn't stomach feeling taken advantage of. In 1985, after deciding that his brothers had cheated him in their settlement, Koch had gone back to court. What followed, Bill Koch said later, would make Dallas and Dynasty look like a playpen. There were private detectives and wiretaps and room bugs and body mics and stolen garbage bags and scurrilous whispering campaigns. There was even a mysterious Israeli security consultant whom Koch's own employees later accused of taping their calls at Koch's behest, a charge Koch denies. Many more lawsuits followed. Fortune called it perhaps the nastiest family feud in American business history. The same mix of traits that admired Koch in ruinous litigation and led him to victory in the America's Cup, contrarian determination, a belief in technology and professional investigators, scads of money, a profound need to win, and an impish glee at sticking it to the man, or, it sometimes seemed, the straw man, would prove equally useful when it came to the Jefferson bottles. In the end, Koch decided to get to the bottom of the matter, and the person he charged with investigating it was a former FBI agent named Jim Elroy. So the last third of the book kind of details Koch's investigation, and I'm not going to give away the ending, of course. But there was another mystery that kind of loomed over the book besides, were these bottles real? And that was, why on earth did the Forbes family spend $156,000 on a bottle of wine? And could it possibly be worth that price? And could a 200-year-old bottle of wine possibly still be drinkable? And the last very short passage I'm going to read addresses that question. Whether the wine would be drinkable or not, and if it was, what it would taste like, was a whole other matter. The 1784 and 1787 vintages of Ikem, opened by Rodenstock earlier in the year, had drawn rave reviews. But that most concentrated of the Sauternes dessert wines, with high alcohol and residual sugar, was better constituted than red table wine to withstand the vinegarizing ravages of bacteria. Red wine was different. No merchant or wine writer was going to say of the 1982 vintage, "Drink now through 2182. The finest Bordeaux might peak after 20 years, stay on that plateau for another 15, and then begin to decline. Yet old wine drinkers routinely opened bottles that were more than 100 years old and spoke of them as if they were still in their prime. How was this possible? It was true that some of the wines Broadbent had turned up in pristine castle cellars had been untouched for more than a century and still dazzled tasters. But such wines were outliers, and the oldest was only 130 years or so. Even the best were appreciated more by the mind than the tongue or nose. They garnered faint praise like still very much alive. The best Baron Elie de Rothschild had been able to say of the 1799 Lafitte, opened at Marvin Overton's seminal vertical tasting in Dallas in 1979, was, "It's wine." Of course, many old wines disappointed. You never knew until you opened it how a bottle would be. When Broadbent tried his 1875 Margaux, he rhapsodized about its extraordinary nose like crystallized violets and clean bandages. At another event, however, he glumly lamented the state of an 1858 Mouton, wincing at its incredibly awful creosote, tarry smell, before jotting in his notebook the ultimate condemnation, not tasted. One of his favorite stories involved a bottle of 1898 Lafitte and the legendary Napa Valley consultant, Andre Chelistruff. At one of the Hublin auctions run by Broadbent, the 4'11" Chelistruff had sampled the old wine and told the room in his émigré's Russian accent, "Tasting old wine is like making love to an old lady." After a dramatic pause, he had continued, "It is possible." After another pause, "It can even be enjoyable." And then following one last sip, "But it requires a little bit of imagination." As for the Forbes bottle, we will never know whether or not it was drinkable, because what happened, and this does not give away, you know, too much, I don't think, but what happened to the Forbes bottle was about a year after the auction where they bought it for $156,000, they had decided to display it in their galleries in downtown Manhattan, and they displayed it under a halogen light, which is about the opposite of what you want to do in a wine cellar. And it wasn't a wine cellar, it was in their brightly lit galleries. And a curator wandered past this bottle and noticed something bobbing in the liquid. And the cork had shriveled up and fallen in. So, if anybody has any questions.
Benjamin, what's the oldest bottle of wine that you've ever drunk yourself?
The oldest bottle of wine that I've drunk is an 1899 Chateau Yquem. Which I actually drank in November, so kind of after I'd finished the research for the book. I went to an amazing tasting in California run by a guy named Bipin Desai, who actually appears in the book, and he's a theoretical physicist at the University of California, but who also happens to be the preeminent organizer of rare wine tastings in America, and now with the increasing marginalization of Hardy Rosenstock, probably the world. And he held a double vertical, and a vertical is a tasting where you're drinking one chateau's wines in several vintages. But this was more than several. This was, the two chateaux were Cheval Blanc and Yquem, and it was something like 45 wines from each over 2 days and four meals. And it was an incredibly decadent, excessive weekend. But the oldest was in 1899. And Yquems and sweet wines in general last longer than a dry red wine, so it wasn't. I drank a 1921 Cheval Blanc at the same tasting, which was a red wine. So it was alive. Yeah, yeah.
Is Rosenstock still alive, and if so, did he cooperate with you on this?
Rosenstock is still alive. He cooperated with me in the fashion in which he cooperates with people, which is by fax. He does not meet with people for the most part. He communicates almost exclusively by fax. He kind of travels around in Europe. He has four homes, one in Munich, one in the Austrian ski village of Kitzbühel, one on the island of Marbella, and one on the French coast near Bordeaux. And you fax him in Munich, and it bounces to wherever he is. And then you get a fax back, and the cut line is obscured, and you don't know exactly where he's faxing you from. But he was always actually quite responsive. He would promptly respond to faxes, but he was just very selective in what he would answer and what he would talk about. And he kind of, you know, it was a bit of a broken record, and he said the same things over and over the years. So he was not that helpful.
How many of the owners who bought the bottles, how many of them were you able to talk to?
I talked to Kip Forbes, who bought the original bottle. I talked to Marvin Shankin, who is the publisher and owner of the Wine Spectator magazine, and he owns one of the bottles. I talked to Bill Koch, who owns four of the bottles. I talked to Count Alexandre de Lursalus, who was the kind of manager, part owner of Chateau Yquem. He had two of the bottles, one empty and one still full. They're now in the possession of Chateau Yquem, which he has left, and it is owned by LVMH. And I talked to Bill Sokolin, who is a New York wine retailer who famously had one of these bottles on consignment and had it insured for $225,000. And he thought that, you know, there was this big wine dinner at the Four Seasons restaurant in Manhattan, and he thought that would be a great opportunity to show off this bottle. And he brought it, and he bumped into a waiter's trolley, and it punctured the bottle, and it all spilled out. And ultimately, the insurance did pay off, but not to him, but to the British merchant who had consigned it to him. And then, I mean, a lot of the bottles have been opened by Rodenstock at his tastings, so I interviewed a lot of people who tasted those bottles. None of these people are Jefferson scholars. They're wine people, and none of them are engraving experts. And from the beginning, Monticello, as you know, had raised significant doubts about whether or not these bottles could possibly have belonged to Jefferson, because Jefferson left this mountain of documents. I mean, every letter he received and a copy of every letter he sent, and every wine purchase he ever made recorded, and the bottles that Rodenstock announced that he had found in this cache just did not tally, you know, with that record. And so what some wine people thought about that, I mean, they all sort of poo-pooed it, but Monticello always was highly skeptical, you know.
It must have been quite daunting to do research to make certain that what you were saying was accurate and complete. Could you just sketch out the nature of the research you did, which sounds like a daunting project?
It was daunting. It was long. I mean, the most daunting thing was getting interviews with billionaires. Billionaires are hard to get interviews with. I learned, you know, Bill Koch took a long time to get an interview with. Kip Forbes was actually very receptive, but he just, you know, travels all the time, so it was just hard to get his time. I started the research originally in 2000, and I interviewed Kip Forbes in 2001, and I interviewed Broadbent for the first time in 2003, and then I kind of shelved the project and came back to it in 2005. And, yeah, I had to just comb through these Jefferson letters and documents to make sure. I mean, it's been written about before in sort of more academic context, and I wanted to go to the primary sources and, you know, make sure I had all the details right, because Rodenstock was very good at finding little areas of ambiguity that he can use to kind of create a smokescreen. And so it was really hard to nail down things well enough that it would be hard for him to evade them.
I mean, I would assume that Christie's should have, before auctioning it, have investigated the background of the wine first. Were they at all embarrassed with what was discovered, and were they helpful to you in writing your book?
Well, Monticello had given someone at Monticello had given an interview in the New York Times before the bottle sold in 1985, in which they aired some of their doubts. They later did a more formal research report, really, you know, showing that it was almost impossible that these bottles could have belonged to Jefferson. So Christie's went ahead and sold the bottle, knowing of those doubts, and they did issue a supplement to the catalog, kind of at the last minute, in which Michael Broadbent laid out, you know, his counter-arguments. And it kind of boiled down to, you know, Monticello said these are almost certainly couldn't have belonged to Jefferson. And Broadbent basically said he couldn't possibly have written down every single wine purchase, and how would you know, and what can I tell you? Like, I just found these bottles, and they have his initials on them, so they must be his. I mean, he was more of a believer, and they were skeptics. Over the years, they've had a kind of ambivalent feeling about the bottles. I mean, they've often used pictures of this bottle in their marketing literature. I mean, it was a pretty big sale for them. Even today, 20 years later, it's the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold. At the time, it was five times as high as the previous record. So it's been kind of a bragging point. Since the Bill Koch's investigation, which led to a lawsuit in the fall of 2006, Christie's has backpedaled a little bit. I mean, one of their auctioneers said, you know, looking back, more questions should have been asked. Broadbent has sort of, his role at Christie's has shrunk a little bit. But Christie's continues to have wine auctions where in the catalogs, the tasting notes for bottles will include tasting notes from Rodenstock tastings. It's a very conflicted kind of attitude they have about it.
What has happened thus far with the movie prospects?
Not much. You know, it's been optioned by a production team, including Will Smith. And they tell me that they're now looking for, you know, the perfect writer to write the screenplay, which is obviously not me. And because I'm right here and I, you know. They're looking past me, and they're looking for that perfect writer, and, you know, that's pretty much where it is. I think the idea is that Will Smith would play the FBI agent who investigates the mystery. So.
One of the most fun elements of the book is the mystery, and is kind of this, all of these characters and did the butler do it kind of mentality that I think you put in it. Did you intend to put that mysterious aspect into it as you wrote it, or as you conceived it, or did that kind of come about as you met with these billionaires and had to fax to people and those kind of things?
That was part of the idea from the beginning. I don't think I realized the depth of the mystery or the complications and sort of twists it would take, because without getting too much into the meat of the book, I mean, over the years, there were several challenges to these bottles, including one guy in Germany who was a friend of Hardy Rodenstock's got a bottle from him for a friendship price of, I think, $5,000 before the record was set. Before Rodenstock realized how much these bottles could possibly fetch. And he later He later tried to sell the bottle, and Rodenstock said, "Hey, I only sold that to you at a friendship price so we could drink it together." And, you know, he thought that was kind of suspicious, and he ended up – well, they ended up trading accusations in German tabloids and, you know, going to court. And eventually this friend took the bottle to a research institute outside of Munich where they carbon dated it. They actually opened the bottle, and they carbon dated the sediment and the wine, and the sediment – appeared to be genuinely old, but the wine dated to 1963. And, you know, at first I thought, okay, case closed, you know, they're phonies, Rodenstock's a phony, you know, whatever. But then Rodenstock ended up coming back with another bottle from the cache, supposedly, and he took it to a Nobel-winning chemist in Zurich who did his own carbon dating on the test, and his test seemed to show that that bottle was authentically old. So then, you know, there was this split there, and then there was a split over the Jefferson evidence because the Monticello report kind of got buried, and Rodenstock put forward a plausible case where it was possible these bottles could have been Jefferson's. And so it really kind of went back and forth over several years. So I knew that was going to be – that was the heart of the mystery that I was hoping to solve. I benefited very serendipitously from the fact that Bill Koch launched this investigation because he had resources that I simply didn't have. And one of those resources was he used FBI toolmark experts who analyzed the engraving and determined that it had been made with a modern power tool.
Are there other wine mysteries like this out there? Is there a lot of this stuff going on? Is this the tip of the iceberg?
From a story perspective, no, in the sense that it took me a long time to find this story, and it was because there just aren't that many great dramatic narratives that happen to be taking place in the wine world or to have taken place. And the other thing is that Hardy Rodenstock was a one-man industry. And while this story is the tip of the iceberg in the sense that there's other counterfeiting that goes on in the wine business, none of it is as high level as this, which involved Rodenstock, who was considered the premier wine collector in Europe, the premier tasting host in Europe, and all these other guys. I mean, Michael Broadbent, Robert Parker, who went to one of Rodenstock's lavish tastings and called it the wine event of my lifetime. Georg Riedel, the maker of the Austrian Crystal, who's a good friend of Rodenstock's. I mean, it really penetrated to the highest levels of the wine business. So. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.